You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, I have a couple of quick announcements as we kick off the new year here. I hope you'll help us fund our production costs for 2017 so I can keep providing you brand new podcasts twice a week. Show your support for the show by giving to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews. Or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. Whatever you can give is always appreciated and will help us keep going over here in 2017. I also want to ask you to take a brief listener survey so we can better understand you, our audience, and find advertisers who are best matched to your interests. Just take 5 minutes to go to podsurvey.com/kick and take the survey. And when you're done, be sure to register to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Again, that's podsurvey.com/kick. Thanks for listening, and now enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. I'm thrilled to have the host of one of my favorite podcasts on the show today. I've been a fan of his work for years. He's the guy who made behavioral economics fun and popular. Well, fun and popular for the rest of us non-economists, at least. Stephen J. Dubner is an award-winning author, journalist, and TV and radio personality. He's best known for his work with economist Stephen Levitt, which have included the runaway bestsellers Freakonomics, A Rogue Economist Explores the Hidden Side of Everything, the sequel Super Freakonomics, Global Cooling, Patriotic Prostitutes, and Why Suicide Bombers Should Buy Life Insurance, Think Like a Freak, the authors of Freakonomics offer to retrain your brain, and When to Rob a Bank, and 131 more warped suggestions and well-intended rants. His other books include Turbulent Souls, Choosing My Religion, Confessions of a Hero Worshipper, and the children's book The Boy with Two Belly Buttons. His journalism has been published in the New York Times, The New Yorker, and Time Magazine, and has been anthologized in The Best American Sports Writing, The Best American Crime Writing, and elsewhere. He also hosts the weekly Freakonomics radio podcast, which receives 5 million downloads a month, and he has a new podcast. It's a fun, educational new game show called Tell Me Something I Don't Know. On today's podcast, Stephen Dubner explains how he came up with Tell Me Something I Don't Know, in part as a way of indulging his own curiosity, and also as an antidote to the echo chamber of misinformation on modern social media. He shares some of the most interesting things he's learned on the show, including why people in Renaissance portraits are always sticking their hands in their coats. And he talks about the time when his fact checker called BS on a story from one of the show's judges, Malcolm Gladwell. We'll discuss the origins of the Freakonomics phenomenon and his friendship with quirky rogue economist Dr. Stephen Levitt. We'll talk about the Freakonomics philosophy of why incentives matter, why correlation is not always causation, and whether or not everyone cheats. Plus some of the perils of exploring the hidden side of everything, and the occasional backlash when a fan's dogma isn't backed up by the data. Coming up when we get freaky today with Stephen Dubner in just a moment. Stephen J. Dubner is an award-winning author, journalist, and TV and radio personality. He's best known as the co-author of the best-selling books Freakonomics, Super Freakonomics, Think Like a Freak, and When to Rob a Bank, as well as his popular Freakonomics podcast. He has a new podcast, a game show no less, that's called Tell Me Something I Don't Know. Stephen, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me here.
Well, before we get to the new game show, I just want to say I have been a fan of Freakonomics ever since the first book. I have been a religious listener of the podcast for years, so I'm about as close as it gets to a super fan or super freak or whatever as it comes.
Well, I appreciate it. You know, it's funny, podcasting, which no one was predicting, you know, 10 or certainly 15 years ago would turn into what it has become. For us, it became, you know, if you write books, which is what I do, I mean, I'm a writer. It's what I always wanted to be for a long time, and I love doing it. And then, but the problem is, you write a book, you spend 2 or 3 or 4 years in a room quietly working, then you put out your book, and then even if you have the good fortune to have it be successful, which the Freakonomics books were, you know, the minute it's out of your hands, it's kind of dead in the water. Like, you've said what you have to say, and it's not going to change at all. It's not going to update. You can't respond to the world. And so Freakonomics Radio, the podcast, became, it was really just, I started it after my partner and I, Steve Levitt, had finished our second book, Super Freakonomics. I was just a little bit, like, bored. I'd been, you know, cooped up in the room for a few years, and I thought it'd be fun to try something a little bit more collaborative. You know, even though Levitt and I collaborate on the books, we do it remotely. He's in Chicago, I'm in New York. So the podcast was just meant to be a goof, but what it became, which I love, is a way to kind of keep the Freakonomics conversation going that began in the books, but now extends. And every week, you know, as it's grown, just to know that there is an audience of people who care about having the same conversations that I do, it's a blast. But the biggest thing for me is it's just a lesson in how horrible we humans are at, well, we're bad at a lot of things, but we're really bad at predicting the future. You know, I had no idea that this would serve that kind of function, but I'm really glad it does, because the kinds of things that I like to write about and think about, they do change as the world evolves and as news evolves. And so I'm glad you listened to it, and I appreciate that you and everybody else listens to it.
Yeah, you were kind of the Philo Farnsworth of podcasting, going back, what, 6 years or so?
Yeah, I think we, in 2010, yeah, so almost 7 years now.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were some podcasts around, and then, you know, the top charts were dominated, as they often are now, by the big public radio shows. So This American Life and Radiolab. But yeah, it was a different environment entirely. But it is remarkable to me, and again, indicative of how hard it is to see the future, to predict the future. It's an old medium, you know, audio recording. It's basically time-delayed radio. Yeah. It's really no different than that. But the fact that the entire universe, for the most part, now walks around with a computer in our pockets or purses, whatever, in the form of an iPhone, and that we often are looking for something to do with our ears or heads while we're doing something else with our hands, makes podcasts kind of, you know, the perfect multitasking information delivery thing, which I was certainly not smart enough to see it coming, and I don't think that many other people were.
You know, and it's funny because I've been such a fan for so long, but I'll confess that I don't know the origin story of Freakonomics. How did you and your Freakonomics co-author, Dr. Steve Levitt, first hook up?
So I am, you know, a writer, a journalist by training, who'd had kind of one earlier career. I played music, I was in this rock band, and that was the dream, and I loved it. And we succeeded to the point where we got a record deal, moved to New York City to start to make our record. And then kind of in the middle of making our first record, I decided I did not want to be a rock star after all, as appealing as it looked like from the outside. I decided that wasn't the life I wanted. So I started planning a writing career. Then I got involved in journalism, and I was at the New York Times, and I was working on a book about what I call the psychology of money, which was really about what we now know as behavioral economics, that was going to be called something like Money Makes Me Happy, Except When It Doesn't. And so it was about, like I say, the psychology of money. And an editor, my editor, asked me if I would write a profile of this young economist named Steve Levitt at the University of Chicago. Levitt was not well known, but he was fairly well known in some circles for one very controversial paper, which claimed that the legalization of abortion in the United States led, a generation later, to a decrease in crime. The notion being that, you know, unwanted right. children are much more are more disproportionately likely to have tough lives and turn into criminals. And so I, not being a very smart person, when my editor said, "Do you want to write about this guy?" I turned him down like two or three times. And the reason was that Levitt, whose work was really interesting, had nothing to do with behavioral economics, nothing to do with money, with what I was writing this book about. But then ultimately, as fate would have it, I was going to be in Chicago anyway for some other work, and I decided, you know, let me download some of his other papers and read them and go spend a little time with him. And Levitt was and is just this fascinating, original, weird thinker who, even though he's an economist, studied all kinds of things that most people wouldn't recognize as economics at all. Things like, abortion and crime was one, but does the name you give your child affect the child's outcome in any way?
Right.
He looked at real estate agents and Ku Klux Klan members and sumo wrestlers. And I was just so taken with him that I did write this fairly long magazine piece for the Times Magazine about Levitt. But after the article had been out a while, someone suggested that maybe we collaborate. And it was an odd couple collaboration. He's really good at a lot of things that I'm not good at all, and maybe vice versa. And so we sat down and we thought, you know, if we can envision having a lot of fun and writing exactly the book about all these topics that we would want to write. In other words, not conforming to some publisher's view of what this should be. If we can really do what we want to do and we think it'd be fun to work together, let's try it. And we did, and they published it, and it worked out.
And I think my biggest takeaway from all the Freakonomics books is that incentives matter, and to a greater or lesser degree, pretty much everyone cheats. How many of these stories usually involve someone one way or another trying to game the system?
Here's the way I would think about that, Ben. I would say the way you just put it, I'm sure we've written something with a very similar quasi-accusatory tone as that. So I'm not accusing you of overstating what we've said. But the way I think about it is this. Yes. In any human endeavor, wherever there are, you know, transactions or interactions to be had, always there will be some share of the populace. It may be a tiny fraction, it may be larger, that want a little bit more than they're willing to pay for. When I say pay, I mean, you know, it might be in dollars, it might be in time, whatever. People who cut a line are stealing your time, really, right? So there are always people who are going to want more than they're willing to pay for. The question is one of magnitude. How bad is the problem? But to me, the big realization is that, you know what, rather than say, oh my gosh, it's terrible, the people who do that are bad people, and therefore I'm going to think of them as belonging to a different category from me. And we do that way too often. The minute someone behaves or thinks a little bit differently from the way I think is acceptable or proper, we just put them in a different category, and we assume that this one perhaps very narrow and observable difference between the two of us is somehow representative of this massive difference, whereas in fact it may be that one visible and observable difference is really pretty insignificant compared to all the other things that we might share. Similarly, You may look at two people who kind of look alike and say, oh, well, I'm going to assume that they're therefore pretty similar in all their beliefs and behaviors, which is a silly way to do it, too, because then you're kind of stereotyping people based on this difference that may be really shallow. So I like to think that, just because someone cheats or steals or lies once in a while, it doesn't necessarily make them a bad person. What it means is that they're responding to some incentive in a way that's, probably a little bit different than you would respond to. But even more important, if a lot of people are cheating or stealing or lying, it means that the person or institution or government, whatever, that created the incentive scheme or the ecosystem or the economy, they didn't do a very good job. And that's one of the challenges of policymakers and economists and social scientists and clergy and parents, is to find ways to set up society and a system and systems in a way that acknowledges that humans, look for shortcuts. Humans are fallible, and acknowledge that that's going to happen, and then try to come up with the best, sanest, most affordable, most rising tide lifts all boats solutions to the problem, and set it up in a way that doesn't unduly punish people who shouldn't be punished, and doesn't tag everyone whoever cheats a little bit as an irredeemable outcast.
Yeah, and the MO for the whole Freakonomics empire, I guess, is that you reveal the hidden side of everything. And I can't listen to Freakonomics or tell me something I don't know without learning something, even if I am not trying to learn something. I'd be curious, what's one hidden revelation that surprised you the most in the past year, either through what you were doing with Freakonomics or through the game show? Anything that really shocked even you?
I think this isn't something that like changed my view of the world in any way, except to make it a little bit more fun. So I don't love going to museums. I like it fine, but my wife loves it. And so especially when we travel with the kids and we take a trip somewhere, we always end up going to two or three museums. And a lot of times those museums have paintings in them, and they're pretty old paintings. And this one contestant on Tell Me Something I Don't Know told us about the fact that in a lot of older paintings, that there would be one thing that was often missing, a lot of paintings of people, one thing that was often missing, which was the hands, or there might be one hand showing. And the reason is that hands were really difficult to paint and therefore were a lot more costly. And so often there'd be a painting that was commissioned where the commissioner fully planned to want both hands, or at least one hand prominently in the painting. But then when they got the price, they said, well, how much is it without the hands? Yeah. So instead, let's have a nice bowl of fruit in front of where the hands would be. And so it's one of those things that ever since I learned that from Tell Me Something I don't Know, whenever I go into a museum now, I just can't help but see all the missing hands in all these paintings. So it does give me a little bit of pleasure.
Do you think that's why Napoleon always has his hands in his shirt and his jacket?
I don't know. I don't know enough to know that, but now I want to.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more with Stephen Dubner when we come back in just a minute. Folks, I'm sure I don't have to tell you, when you're constantly on the go, life gets chaotic. You're working late, go to the gym, get the dry cleaning, it never ends. And I just don't have the time to be running back and forth to the grocery store. That's why Home Chef is my new best friend. Home Chef offers delicious, easy-to-prepare meals delivered straight to my door. There's no headaches or hassles. Home Chef is for busy professionals like you and I that love a tasty meal but don't have all the time to plan and prep. With Home Chef, I get to cook like a 5-star chef whenever I want. And anyone will tell you I am definitely no 5-star chef. Their mouth-watering meals and pre-portioned ingredients are so easy to prepare, it only takes 30 minutes. And that gives me more time to relax after surviving another crazy busy day. Just last night, I had Home Chef's pork chop Chateaubriand with Duchess potatoes and roasted carrots. I was literally shocked at what I was capable of with Home Chef. The veggies and meat were fresh, perfectly seasoned. It tasted fantastic. It was as good or better than anything I've had in a restaurant recently. So now next up, I'm going to try shrimp and sweet pea risotto with sun-dried tomatoes and Parmesan. How good does that sound? With 13 dinner options and new breakfasts that rotate each week, Home Chef has something to delight everyone. Home Chef's weekly meal delivery system fits my crazy schedule, and that's why I keep coming back. Craft a delicious meal that you're guaranteed to go wild for. And if you go to homechef.com/kickass right now, you'll get $30 in free meals. That's homechef.com/kickass for $30 in free meals. Do yourself a favor. Make your life easier and more delicious. Go to homechef.com/kickass. So it's a new year now, and there's no better time to launch an online business or expand your online presence for your existing business, and GoDaddy.com wants to help. GoDaddy's mission is to radically shift the global economy toward life-fulfilling independent ventures, helping their customers kick ass by giving them the tools, insights, and the people to transform their ideas and personal initiatives into success. GoDaddy is the world's largest technology provider dedicated to small business and the largest domain registrar with over 62 million domain names under management and big savings over other registrars. Their award-winning 24/7 support will help build your online business and give you everything you need to get up and running. Whether you have a new idea or an established business, the key to success online starts with a great domain name, and GoDaddy is trusted by 13 million customers. That's more than any other registrar. And right now, my listeners can get a special discount on a GoDaddy domain if you just use my offer code KICK30 at checkout to get 30% off new purchases. That's GoDaddy.com and offer code KICK30 for 30% off. You don't have to spend a fortune on a domain. Just go to GoDaddy.com and type in the offer code KICK30 at checkout for 30% off and launch your online business today. The 2016 election is now in the history books, but I know there are a lot of folks out there who are still feeling the burn. Well, guess what? Bernie Sanders has a new book that's now 7 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list called Our Revolution, A Future to Believe In. You might remember when Bernie Sanders began his race for the presidency, it was considered by the political establishment and the media to be a fringe campaign, something not to be taken seriously. But by the time Sanders' campaign came to a close, whether you were on the right or left, you could not deny that Bernie had run one of the most consequential campaigns in modern history. And though the campaign is over, Bernie isn't going anywhere, because for Bernie Sanders, the political revolution has just begun. You can follow along as Bernie Sanders seeks to keep the new administration in check and lays out his vision of a progressive future in his new multi-month New York Times bestseller, Our Revolution, A Future to Believe In. Referring to his book, The Washington Post says that Sanders is spinning lessons about what really matters in life. Go behind the scenes to learn the details of Sanders' historic primary fight and the people who made it possible in Our Revolution. Available in hardcover, ebook, and wherever books are sold, with an audiobook read by Bernie Sanders himself and Mark Ruffalo. For more information, visit OurRevolutionBook.com and hashtag ReadTheBurn. Again, that's OurRevolutionBook.com. And now, back to the podcast. You know, I almost feel bad for you at times because I don't think that you're a terribly political guy, but you seem to often find yourself in the reluctant position of taking on this or that group's sacred cow when the facts don't support the dogma or their assumptions. Do you get a lot of hate mail or people who want to shoot the messenger just because they don't like the data?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I really admired about Leavitt, as an academic researcher especially, you're in one of the few realms where you can really do the work you want to do, and you really don't have to care at all about what other people think of it, you know, as long as you can get some papers published. So I would say that Leavitt and I are both pretty devoutly apolitical. There's a great freedom in just knowing that, you know, We may be wrong. We try as hard as we can to not be wrong. We may be wrong, but what we're not doing is we're not proselytizing. We're not advocating for something because we want it to be so. We're trying to explain what we think really is so. And so, yeah, you get people who complain, but there are always going to be people who don't like what you do or what you say, often for their own reasons, of their personal preferences. And look, if you're a true liberal or tolerant person or a progressive, you should be in favor of what are called heterogeneous preferences, the idea that people should be allowed to hold different kinds of beliefs from you, and yet still, you know, you can be, you know, under the same flag or whatnot. And so I find that what we do mostly, the kind of people we upset mostly, are people who have blinded themselves so much to the reality because they're so devout about a particular cause that they can't look beyond that. And
Dunning-Kruger effect, right?
So, you know, you do your best, try to ignore it.
You know, especially after this last election, I feel like we're so cordoned off in our own little echo chamber that we don't get outside perspectives and we don't learn anything that way. Was that maybe part of the idea to make this show an antidote to that?
Yeah, entirely. I mean, it's funny. You know, one thing that shocked me after the election, which obviously was a very, I don't know if toxic is the right word. I know it's been used. It was a very, there's just a lot of animosity and a lot of separation and division and all this. And one thing that shocked me afterwards, the day after, I think it was the day after the election when Trump had won and Trump went to visit Obama in the White House. They had this conversation that was supposed to be just a, you know, quick hello, 15 minutes, whatever, and it turned into an hour plus conversation. And afterwards, when they talked to the press, they both seemed, you know, Trump seemed kind of humbled and, you know, and really taken with the gravity of the situation and grateful to Obama. And Obama seemed a little bit, I don't know, and again, this may all have dissolved by now, but Obama seemed a little bit like, yeah, okay, you know, the guy knows what he's getting into and he's a serious person, he's going to appreciate it. But the thing that shocked me was one of them, I can't remember which one, said, you know, this is the first time we've ever sat down face-to-face and talked. And I thought, holy, are you kidding me? These are two of, you know, the president of the United States and the incoming president of the United States, who'd been a very high-profile guy for many years, that these two guys had never sat down for a conversation. And it and you just think it's a lot easier to demonize or vilify someone who is the other, who, you know, is not in your orbit. And so there's something really valuable, I think, about the notion of, you know, whether it's breaking bread or breaking down barriers or just having a conversation with someone who is very, very, very different from you. And you may find that, in fact, those differences are less material than you imagine.
Right. And that's the only way you learn anything, is interacting with people who have a different experience or a different background. And I think Tell Me Something I Don't Know puts a neat twist on that, because you have experts on various topics revealing things that may not necessarily be widely known or might go against popular assumptions. So tell me, how did you come up with the idea for this game show?
So this game show, Tell Me Something I Don't Know, grew out of really this habit that I developed, mostly on airplanes, but in other places, when I would be put into a situation, I'm pretty shy by nature, I've always been really shy. When I'm put into a situation with other people and you're kind of expected to have some kind of conversation, it's often hard for me. And one habit that I fell into is I would ask them, you know, what do you do? Are you if it's a young person, you're a student, or if older, what's your job, blah, blah, blah. And then they would tell me. And then I would say, oh, well, you know, tell me something I don't know about being a, you know, porn film producer. Tell me something I don't know about being a nuclear engineer. And I found that it was the kind of question that most people, when they're invited, they just really get into it, because most of us are fairly passionate about who we are and what we do. And we often don't have someone ask us, you know, tell me something I don't know about that.
Yeah, so basically you created an elaborate game show to cover for your social shortcomings and indulge your curiosity, huh?
That's the idea. And I found that what I learned from people when I asked that simple question was great. It was not only an icebreaker, but I learned a lot. So I just took that question and sort of applied it in the realm of journalism, which is what I do. And often it's that kind of simple question that journalists are a little bit afraid to ask because you want to sound smart and sophisticated. You know, I'd rather ask a question that's full of all kinds of statistics and nuances, but sometimes it's really good to just say, whether it's to the President of the United States, hey, tell me something I don't know about being the President of the United States. What's something that, you know, is not reported on? And so this game show is meant to invite the world, basically, onto our stage and tell us something we don't know about any given topic. And as the show's going on, we're in the middle of taping our second season now. We're zoning in more on a little more concrete themes. So coming up, we're taping episodes on money, on religion, on medicine, and it's journalism essentially, but with a game show format.
Yeah, and let's talk about the format. Briefly explain how the game show works.
Rather than us, the people running the show, being the kind of experts who have a piece of trivia that we're forcing people to guess and making them, you know, they're either right or wrong. It's us, the so-called, the people running the show in power, who are trying to learn from the audience. And I love the dynamic of it. So,
that makes it a lot of fun. Because you do, the contestants are the experts. I guess the judges are brilliant and intelligent people in their own right. But the contestants have a particular expertise that they draw on. And I guess the takeaway from me is that probably just about everyone is an expert at something.
I think that's true. You know, I used to have this fantasy of, I read about someone who did this once. It's not an original fantasy. There was a newspaper columnist somewhere, I want to say out west, maybe Oregon or state of Washington, who basically would open the phone book back when there were phone books and every day just pick someone, a random person, and go to their house and write a story about that person under the premise that everybody has a story.
Show up at their house.
I've always loved that notion. And so, yeah, this is built a little bit on that same sentiment.
Well, I love Tell Me Something I Don't Know because, you know, for me, it almost kind of harkens back to when we used to have real quiz shows where the smartest guy in the room was the winner. And, you know, it seems like now quiz shows evolved into game shows and it's more reality TV than it is about knowledge.
Yeah, so Tell Me Something I Don't Know, the game show is designed exactly this. It's basically to deliver, you know, one thing after the next that is literally something you didn't know that, you know, we just kind of, it's kind of an open source journalism where we invite people to come tell us interesting things about it, a given theme.
You have a fact checker to make sure that they're not trying to put one over on people. They're pretty fast with the Googling. Has the fact checker ever just blatantly called BS on one of the contestants or one of the judges?
All right, so I don't think anyone has outright lied or fabricated, which is important.
Yet.
sometimes they'll get a detail wrong. Although, honestly, I think that's more a function of nerves, because people aren't really coming to punk us. But then we do have these different rounds toward the end where our celebrity panelists will have to come up with something out of their heads on a random topic. And we did have one instance where my friend Malcolm Gladwell, who's a writer that I really admire, his topic was bread, I think. And he told us an interesting story about, I think it was focaccia. And the fact checker delightedly found out that the story was totally wrong. And so it provided a moment of, you know, I think a lot of people in the theater when it was being taped, they thought that Malcolm was actually just making it up. In retrospect, what turned out really happened was that the story was right, but Malcolm got the bread wrong. It was ciabatta instead of focaccia. So it wasn't like we were being lied to. He just got a little bit confused. But I really like having the fact checker on hand just because you never know.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe Malcolm needed to dedicate another 10,000 hours to study, learning
bread
his breads.
Study.
Yeah. Well, before we go, I got to say, I love the show. I do have one small criticism.
Please.
What's with the crummy prizes? A crate of passion fruits, a stuffed bird, my personal favorite, rubber surgical gloves. I mean, come on, you're Mr. Freakonomics. Aren't you supposed to be all about incentives?
What would you suggest? What would be a better prize?
I don't know. Because you're all about incentives. Surely we can get a sponsor to come up with something here. Now,
yeah,
they are all appropriate to the theme, though.
There were some times when we thought about just kind of upping the ante on the prizes, making them more, I guess, valuable is the word. But I will say this. We're producing this show ourselves out of pocket.
And so
every dollar is important. So if we can give, one of my favorites was we gave a custom-made subway sign where we theoretically renamed a famous New York City subway station after the name of the winner and had the sign made up. And that only costs us maybe $100 or $200.
Okay.
So I think it's not so much that we're cheap,
okay,
although we are. I think it's just we haven't applied our full creativity yet to the prizes. So
yeah, no flat screen TVs.
I appreciate you're pointing out how bad we've been at that, and now I know that as we go forward, that's an area of improvement for us. So
I appreciate
that feedback.
Yeah, well, I'll give you credit for at least you put a lot of thought into it. And that's what really counts, isn't it?
Probably not as much as necessary, but we try.
Just real quick, what was the best book you read last year? I figure you're a good guy to ask that.
Let's see. So I'm a bad person to ask that because I mostly only finish books that I'm reading for my writing.
Okay.
I start and abandon probably 85 or 90% of all books. I'll tell you one that I don't know if this is the best, one that I really enjoyed, in part because it surprised me a lot, but also it was really well written, was Trevor Noah's memoir called Born a Crime.
Oh, yeah.
And what I liked about it is, you know, I like stand-up comedy. I like, I think a lot of comics are really smart people who write their own material, and, you know, I like comedy more than entertainment generally. But a lot of books written by comics are just kind of repackaging of their material.
Yeah.
And Trevor Noah's book is a really interesting memoir about a very unusual and very bright kid growing up as a mixed race kid in South Africa toward the end of apartheid. And I learned a lot, and I was just moved a lot. And that is a real treat because that's not what I was expecting when I sat down to read a memoir by a stand-up comic. And so I think having read that now, I'm not surprised that he has connected with people so differently than a typical late-night comedy show host, because I think that there's something really to be said for an outsider holding the mirror up to society. You have a different kind of mirror than most people.
Yeah.
His view of humankind has been informed by his background, which is really extreme and interesting. And so him just succeeding on a personal level is interesting, but the thoughts that he's developed along the way and the worldview he's developed along the way are really, I would really recommend that. So yeah, I thought that was a great book.
Yeah, I think I read about half of that. So now I'm going to finish it based on your recommendation.
Yeah.
Well, again, the podcast is called Tell Me Something I Don't Know. Subscribe to it on iTunes. Did I see that you're taking the show on tour? Is that right? How can people get in the studio audience?
Yes, we tape live in theaters, and so far we've done only New York, which is where we're based. We've taped, maybe 10 or 12 by now. Not all have been released yet. But yeah, we've got our first out-of-town dates. We are in Washington, D.C. on March 6th and 7th, and in Boston on March 14th, 15th, 16th, somewhere in there, the week after, I know. And if anyone's interested in coming to any of these shows, we're also doing more shows in New York soon. So for any information, our website is tmsidk.com, tmsidk as in tell me something I don't know. So people should come to the show, but honestly, the other thing that's really fun is if you're in one of these places, Or if you want to travel, a lot of people have traveled to be on the show. If you want to be a contestant, if you want to tell me something I don't know, that's you can also sign up to be a contestant on that same site, tmsidk.com.
Terrific, terrific. No plans to come to L.A. yet?
Big plans to come to L.A., but not yet.
Okay.
I mean, I certainly want to get there because I think that the panelists that we could have would be great, and I think the IDKs, what we call the IDKs, the people telling us stuff, I think would be a lot of fun. So, yeah, we definitely want to do a Los Angeles, San Francisco, and maybe Seattle trip at some point. But, again, this is a startup on my dime right now, and so so we're just having to try to not lose too much money at one time. So if we can figure out how to make that happen in L.A., we'll be there. So,
awesome.
You know, realistically, I'm thinking hopefully by next fall, by the fall of 2017, I'd love to get to the West Coast.
Okay. That. Well, if you need a fact checker, I'm a masterful Googler. So
it's a deal. I'd love it. All right. That
awesome.
Is awesome. And we pay really poorly, just so you know.
So even worse than the prizes.
I appreciate you committing on the air like this. It's a commitment device that we can hold you to.
Okay. Well, that's fair. You got me on audio. Again, it's Tell Me Something I Don't Know. Stephen Dubner, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks so much. It was a real pleasure.
Well, that's the show, folks. Don't forget, when you're constantly on the go and there's no time to be running to the grocery store, let Home Chef deliver easy-to-prepare meals straight to your door. To select from tons of recipes you're guaranteed to go wild for, go to homechef.com/kickass and you'll get $30 in free meals. Go to homechef.com/kickass. Thanks again to Stephen Dubner for joining me on the show. And if you enjoyed today's episode, then subscribe to his new podcast, Tell Me Something I Don't Know, on iTunes. And I also recommend his Freakonomics radio podcast, also available on iTunes. You can order his books Freakonomics, Super Freakonomics, How to Think Like a Freak, and When to Rob a Bank on Amazon, or you can download any of the audio versions for free through a special trial offer just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickassnews. For more information or to join the studio audience for Tell Me Something I Don't Know, visit Freakonomics.com and follow Stephen Dubner on Twitter at Freakonomics. Don't forget to take our listener survey so we can keep the show free and find advertisers who are best matched to you, our listeners. Just take 5 minutes to go to podsurvey.com/kick and take the survey. And when you're done, be sure to register for that $100 Amazon gift card giveaway. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. You can like Kick-Ass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at KAPolitics. And please be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/KickAssNews or click on the donate button at KickAssNews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.